From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Chief Justice John Roberts is presiding over a court that will soon announce its ruling in the case of President Obama's Affordable Health Care Act. There's some expectation the court will strike down parts of the law in a 5-4 decision. If you couple that with other significant rulings that have come 5-4 in the Roberts court, you may wonder about how the dynamics of politics and consensus are playing out. Roberts has said there's a difference between being a judge and being a law professor, that a ruling isn't just about legal coherence, but where a question fits in the body of law and how it's perceived by the public. Today in the program, we're talking about the personality and character of the Supreme Court. The legal scholar Jeffrey Rosen is our guest. He'll help us understand the principle of judicial temperament and what the health care ruling will mean for the reputation of the Roberts Court. After the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's such an aura of mystery that comes from the Supreme Court. The building itself, with all of those carvings and high-minded quotations, the rituals, the rules, the curtains and robes. But the legal scholar Jeffrey Rosen says this impression of justices as impersonal legal oracles is a myth. The fact is, he says, the court is deeply human, and as we all await a crucial decision from the court about the Affordable Health Care Act, it might not be a bad idea to remind ourselves about how it all really works. Today in the program, Jeffrey Rosen is joining us to break down the idea of judicial temperament, the way the justices of the court form and express their opinions, how they play off each other, how they balance their ideological agendas against the larger interests of the court itself. At the heart of all of this is Chief Justice John Roberts and his efforts to achieve consensus. We're talking about how the Roberts Court fits in history and explain the stakes in this upcoming decision as well. We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Jeffrey Rosen is a law professor at George Washington University and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He's been the legal affairs editor at the magazine The New Republic for some 20 years now. He's also the author of several books, including The Supreme Court, The Personalities and Rivalries That Defined America. Jeffrey Rosen is based in Washington, D.C., though he's currently in Ohio for a conference, and he's joining us there by phone. Jeffrey Rosen, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thank you. It's great to talk with you.
I wanted to jump right in, if we could, Jeffrey Rosen, with the idea of judicial temperament, because I know you've been writing about it, thinking about it for some time. I wanted you to first set the stage for the concept, though, if you would, as you do in your book, because you contrast these two impassioned arguments from Supreme Court justices who served about 50 years apart. It was Hugo Black on one hand, and then you have Clarence Thomas on the other. And you write about the kind of remarkable similarities between the two, but you also say that their opinions, the way they saw the idea of judicial temperament, were kind of at odds or were different expressions of it. Talk about that, if you would.
Yes, indeed. Hugo Black and Clarence Thomas are such an interesting pairing, I think, because in many ways, as you suggest, their judicial philosophies were similar. Mm. Black was a liberal textualist, and Thomas is a conservative textualist or originalist. Both believed that judges should only enforce rights that explicitly appeared in the Constitution and that they should look to the original understanding of the men who wrote and ratified it. Mm. But when it came to temperament, Black and Douglas could not be more different. Black was a former senator from Alabama. As it happens, of course, he was also a former member of the Ku Klux Klan, who was so embarrassed when this was revealed after his confirmation that he devoted his career to championing civil rights and civil liberties, as if he wanted to atone for his sins in the past. But he knew how to build consensus. He was the right-hand man of Chief Justice Earl Warren during the early years of Warren's chief justiceship, and helped Warren achieve a unanimous court in Brown v. Board of Education by persuading all of the justices that it was in the court's interest to be unanimous. Clarence Thomas, by contrast, is very much of a loner. His friend Justice Scalia has said of Thomas, "The difference between me and Thomas is that he would vote to overturn any decision that he thinks is wrong. I wouldn't do that," says Scalia, "because I'm not a nut." And he's sort of using nut in a friendly way, but he's suggesting that Thomas is so zealously devoted to his vision of the original understanding of the Constitution, he's not interested in compromise, he's not interested in building majorities in most cases. He's just as happy to be in dissent, basically my way or the highway. And that's a very different view of the court, and I think it's made Thomas less successful in forging consensus than Black was.
Here's what you write in the book. You say that those who have judicial temperament in mind find that the court is their oyster. Those who do not are often condemned to grumbling on the sidelines. Explain the difference between Thomas's perspective and Black's perspective a little more, if you would.
Well, Black transformed the law in his own image. His vision of free expression, his vision of civil rights, his insistence on deference to Congress and economic matters, all that was he was able to achieve because of his powers of persuasion, his people skills in a way. Thomas is great fun to teach, is always interesting and provocative because he has such strong views, but at least so far he's not come close to achieving a consensus for his view that radically limited congressional power is the norm, that there should be much more religious expression in the public sphere. Basically, he's been less successful in persuading others to join him.
I mentioned at the introduction of the show the myth that sort of has settled over the Supreme Court in some ways. And you write about in your book that it's that one last institution of government that had for so long sustained Olympian sense of mystery is how you put it. I'm wondering, do you think that's changing at all, or do you think it's still true?
I think it is changing. We've seen in the remarkable debate leading up to the healthcare decision, recent polls sponsored by the New York Times and others suggesting that the court's legitimacy ratings, its approval ratings in the sense of how many citizens believe in its legitimacy, is at an all-time low of 44%. It was as high as 50% in 2000. I think it hasn't been this low in memory. Another Washington Post poll suggested that 50% of the country expects the justices to rule along partisan ideological lines in the healthcare case, with five Republicans voting to strike it down and four Democrats voting to uphold it. And this is precisely what Chief Justice John Roberts worried about when he told me in an interview that he gave for that appeared in that book and at the end of his first term as Chief Justice in 2006. He said it was bad for the court and bad for the country for people to perceive the court in partisan terms, to focus on the 5-4 decisions and the ideological alignments. He complained that his colleagues were acting more like law professors than members of a collegial court, and he said he was going to make it his mission as Chief Justice to avoid 5-4 rulings along predictable ideological lines, to persuade his court, his colleagues, to converge around narrow, unanimous opinions and to avoid broad constitutional rulings. And he said that he was heartened in all this by the vision of his greatest predecessor, John Marshall, who succeeded, said Roberts, not just because of his brilliance, but because of his temperament. It was Chief Justice Roberts who stressed to me the importance of temperament in making a successful Chief Justice in particular. And Roberts said that Marshall's colleagues trusted him, they liked him, Republicans and Federalists were willing to converge around opinions written by Marshall because they thought he was a fair dealer. And Roberts said by promoting unanimity and avoiding partisan divisions, Marshall converted the court from one of the most embattled institutions into one of the strongest and most confident. So I was very struck by the passion with which Roberts laid out this vision of unanimity and avoiding 5-4 decisions. And, of course, it hasn't quite turned out the way that he expected.
No. Which we'll get to as we go. But this idea of temperament, as you say in your book, it's really hard to define. You're talking about John Marshall, and you talk about how he was a good guy. I mean, he was funny and he was modest. People said he had a good laugh. He had a light touch. He didn't wear ostentatious, you know, clothes. He wore that simple black robe. And it's interesting, John Roberts also believes, as you say in the book, that Marshall's temperament came in part from his time serving as a soldier at Valley Forge. So what is it? What is temperament? Is it just the idea of modesty and being a good person, or what is it, do you think?
It is hard to define, and I don't know if it's like obscenity that you know it when you see it. John Roberts defined it as a willingness to put the interests of the court above your ideological agenda, the sort of institution-mindedness, which requires a certain humility and self-abnegation. In Marshall's case, he certainly had that, but he also had a modesty, a lack of affect. He was famous for his shambling clothes. When he went to the Richmond market, a young man threw him a quarter and asked him to carry his turkey home because he thought that he was a servant. Marshall also emphasized the personal dynamic. He persuaded his colleagues to live together in the same boarding house in Washington, D.C. They would discuss cases over a hogshead of Marshall's favorite drink, which was Madeira, and all the justices would get buzzed, and all the cases were unanimous. Hmm. So this is, Roberts was talking about embracing this model of the Madeira model, but it just suggests that when the justices socialize with each other, when they trust each other, when there's no personal animus, they're more willing to compromise, to be moderate, to not polarize. Hmm. So maybe these are all aspects of judicial temperament.
So you've got Roberts, who's this model of modesty and geniality. Let's talk about the anti-type, as you call it. Is it Taney? Roger Taney?
Taney.
Taney, right.
Yeah.
He's a good lawyer, but he was shy. He's frail. Seemed a little passive-aggressive from my reading of it all. But he was the opposite in some ways of Marshall.
He was. Just as you say, he was a good lawyer. He was thought to basically continue Marshall's pro-nationalist legacy with a little bit more attention to states' rights, but he was doing just fine as Chief Justice until he overreached. First, during he wrote the infamous Dred Scott opinion, one of the most notorious in American history, which reached out to decide an unnecessary constitutional question, struck down the Missouri Compromise, helped to precipitate the Civil War, and provoked a tremendous backlash from Abraham Lincoln, who essentially said that he, although he'd abide by the particular terms of the decision, would not apply it more broadly. And then the decision was reversed by no fewer than three constitutional amendments after the Civil War. And during the war, Taney confronted Lincoln again. He insisted that Lincoln had violated the Constitution by suspending the writ of habeas corpus without congressional approval. And then Taney was so eager to get his decision out that he had it privately printed and basically handed it out, on the steps of the Capitol. It was like a sort of proto-blogger of his day. And I have one of these pamphlets. It was given to me as a present by one of my favorite teachers, a wedding present, and it says, printed on the authority of the Chief Justice. Hmm. And Lincoln just responded to this fit of pique by essentially ignoring Taney, and he died in Washington, a kind of reviled and forgotten figure who just is a model for overestimating his own personal power and lacking that sense of humility that Marshall had in spades.
John Roberts seems to have a better sense of power. I mean, he often is self-deprecating when he talks about the power he has, almost as if he says, I have one vote. I have the assigning power, the assignment power, and that's about it. Does he have a little better sense of the perspective of the power of his position?
Well, he certainly is personally appealing, as you say. He's self-deprecating. Everyone saw in the confirmation hearings how smooth he is. So his colleagues have spoken well of him. Even his liberal colleagues, Justice Stevens, before he retired, told me in an interview that everyone liked Roberts. They respected him. They'd enjoyed working with him as an advocate. But then when I asked, is Roberts going to succeed in his goal of avoiding 5-4 decisions, Stevens said, I don't think so. That basically it takes 5 votes around here to do anything, and people have very strong views and are not inclined to compromise. And as it happened, when Stevens and I talked, which was just about, I think, 3 years ago, the number of 5-4 decisions were at an all-time high.
Yeah.
This was the term where the court struck down affirmative action, and this was the term that upheld partial birth abortion laws and struck down the first campaign finance law, and the justices were sniping at each other in personal terms. So I think even Roberts himself would have to concede that so far his goal of avoiding 5-4 decisions and promoting narrow unanimous ones has been a mixed success at best, and that's what makes the stakes for this healthcare decision so very high.
But how do you balance your own ideological views, your own principle of the law, with the, you know, the larger interests of the court itself? You mentioned that Chief Justice Roberts had told you that the different that there is a difference between being a judge and being a law professor. And he said this to you, which you write in your book, that it's not just analytical coherence. It's where a particular ruling fits in the context of other established law, but also how it's going to be received as law. Now, what does he mean by that, how it's going to be received, that the public has a role here too in terms of the way they perceive all of this?
I think so. I think he wasn't saying the justices should follow the polls, but his sense was that when the public perceives the court to be polarizing on partisan grounds, when they think the court is making decisions based on politics rather than law, they're not likely to trust the court as a neutral arbiter. That doesn't mean they'll defy the court openly, but they'll be more less bipartisan, less authority for the court. And in some ways, you see precisely what Roberts feared in a series of remarkable lower court opinions recently, where lower court judges on both sides of the political spectrum have been almost defying the Supreme Court or criticizing opinions, even if they hold their nose and apply them. There's a remarkable decision in Montana, which essentially refuses to follow the Citizens United decision striking down campaign finance reform on the grounds that Montana has a special history of corruption that didn't exist at the federal level. And the dissenting judge in that case said, "I despise Citizens United as much as my colleagues. I think it's a terrible decision, but as a lower court judge, I'm bound to uphold it." I think that kind of rhetoric, and we'll see whether the court decides to hear the Montana case and what it does with it, that kind of rhetoric is what Roberts feared when he said that people would not respect the court as a neutral institution.
I wanted to ask, there are a couple of in your book you've written about the good examples and the not so good examples of chief justices who are trying to apply this idea of judicial temperament. Chief Justice Berger was not so good. Earl Warren, though, was an example of someone who seemed to have figured it out. You talk about how he, of course, the role that he played in the groundbreaking decision Brown versus the Board of Education, and how he privately visited skeptical justices. Seems like there was that personal dynamic, lobbying on a personal way that seems to have been effective or important anyway for those who understand the idea of temperament.
Yes, it was surely important that Warren was a former governor of California, a former Republican candidate for vice president, viewed as very moderate. He had the standing to go around to the undecided justices in Brown and ask them to make the decision unanimous for the good of the court. And it all came down to a single holdout, Stanley Reed from Kentucky, a Southerner. And Warren visited him and said, "It's all up to you, Stanley, but it's going to be bad for you and bad for the court if you're alone in dissent." And Reed decided to make it unanimous. Warren reads the Brown decision to a spellbound courtroom, and when he says it's unanimous, Thurgood Marshall, arguing the case, looks up at Stanley Reed, and he can't believe that this Southern segregationist has joined the decision, and Reed nods down at him in recognition. A remarkable moment and a testament to the power of Warren's the skills of persuasion.
Do you know whether John Roberts has made similar appeals to his court?
I know of some cases where he has succeeded. A few cases where he succeeded in doing what he said he would do, that is, promoting unanimity and avoiding divisive constitutional rulings. One was a decision which involved the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act a few years ago, and many expected the court to strike down the Voting Rights Act by a 5-4 vote. But in a surprising decision, Roberts upheld the act. It was 8-1, and Roberts essentially invented an argument that hadn't occurred to anyone, the government or the parties or anyone else, and said that the municipal utility district that wanted to change its polling place could opt out of the Federal Voting Rights Act because of some technicality that essentially Roberts invented. Now, that seems like an example of judicial statesmanship, stepping away from the constitutional brink. Some reporting I did after that decision came down suggested it might have been a little more complicated, that in fact the initial vote may have been 5-4 to strike down the Voting Rights Act, but then Justice Anthony Kennedy got cold feet And once he'd lost his majority, Roberts decided it'd be better to make it unanimous. If that's the case, that doesn't bode well for the case that will challenge the Voting Rights Act again, which is going to be up before the court next year. But at least, given the most charitable explanation, there's one example of Roberts deciding that unanimity is more important than even legal coherence, and it's okay to make up arguments as long as you can avoid a big constitutional conflict.
Kennedy's an interesting figure. You write about him in the sense that, as you say, indecisive justices are often less effective. You say Anthony Kennedy, and I guess we probably all know this, he tends to brood, you say, as a kind of a self-dramatizing tendency that leads him to agonize about particular cases. But of course, he's also a crucial swing vote. Where does Kennedy fit in the mix today?
Well, in some ways, as in all matters involving the court, it all comes down to Kennedy. When we talked, Roberts asked me who I thought would be his biggest obstacle, the justice most opposed to his view of unanimity. Mm. And I had a brain freeze and couldn't think of it, but Roberts was referring to Kennedy because right now it's the Kennedy court, not the Roberts court. When he goes left, the court goes left. When he goes right, the court goes right. Lawyers have to fall on their knees before him and file these things that are jokingly known as Kennedy briefs, where basically the lawyers just praise the wisdom and genius of Justice Kennedy and quote his prior opinions. But Kennedy has many virtues, but a preference for narrow opinions is not one of them. He likes sweeping gestures and broad constitutional rulings. So when Kennedy, in the Citizens United case, insisted on a sweeping ruling that corporations have the same First Amendment rights as real persons, Roberts was not able to pursue his goal of writing the decision more narrowly. Mm. That's the goal that a recent article by Jeff Toobin suggested. So that indicates that Roberts can't do it alone, which he acknowledged when we talk. Part of his success has to do with whether or not his colleagues share his vision. And to the degree that they don't, and Kennedy most assuredly doesn't, then he's not going to be able to get unanimity.
Now contrast Kennedy with Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who, as you point out, was one of the most decisive justices on the court. What difference does it make for a justice to be decisive like Justice Sandra Day O'Connor?
She was indeed decisive. I had interviewed her a few years before she retired, and when we left the interview and went into her outer office, I realized I'd left a book inside that I'd brought to discuss with her, and went back to get it and saw there was a pillow on the seat where she'd been sitting, and on the pillow was embroidered, "Maybe in error, but never in doubt."
Right.
And that sort of summed up her creed. She was a former state legislator, the last politician to serve on the court, and there are none now. She knew about the value of compromise. She would invite Democrats and Republicans over to her house in Arizona when she was majority leader and make them Tex-Mex food, and basically they'd figure out deals over dinner. And once she made up her mind, and she was certainly willing to compromise and to cut things right down the middle, she never looked back. And those are all a politician's virtues, and it made her extraordinarily effective. It was the O'Connor court for at least a decade, and she kept the court almost more closely in the mainstream, in the middle of American politics, than even Congress and the president at times. And that was really a testament to her temperament.
Mm. So we're talking about how decisive justices tend to be more effective. How do you rate Antonin Scalia? Decisive? Effective? Where does he fit?
He's certainly decisive. He's wonderfully confident of his own abilities. He writes like a dream. Mm. He is extremely funny. A recent survey suggested that he was the funniest justice based on the number of laughs that he got in the courtroom. This is what summer associates in law firms have to do over the summer,
right,
to count up the number of laughs. Although his humor sometimes has a kind of sharp edge. A lawyer was fumbling for the right answer to a question, and Scalia said, "When you find it, say bingo." So you have to be prepared when you argue before him.
Right.
But effective? Hard to say. On the one hand, he's been tremendously influential in changing the terms of constitutional debate. His philosophy of original understanding is now engaged by the left and the right. Ronald Dworkin, the great liberal political philosopher, said in a debate with Scalia not long ago, we're all originalists now, and Democrats as well as Republicans accept the legitimacy of making arguments based on constitutional text and history, and much of that has to do with Scalia's influence and vision. On the other hand, he's not, at least until now, been tremendously successful at getting majorities for his unique originalist approach to questions. Roberts and Alito are not especially interested in that methodology, and Scalia's crusades, some of them quixotic, some of them even ideologically surprising, like his recent insistence that the Confrontation Clause of the Constitution forbade forensic evidence from being introduced unless someone could testify about his accuracy. Mm. He was on the dissenting side of those cases. So in that sense, because he's not willing to compromise and engage, he's been less effective. And his friend, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, with whom he has Christmas or New Year's dinner every year, and they go to the opera together, they're personally close, but she has said that he might be more effective if he were a little bit less of a blustering and a little bit less sharp in his attacks.
Ginsburg, how effective do you figure she is in influencing her colleagues?
She is a loner. She's remarkably principled. Roberts thought that she would be an ally because she prefers incremental and narrow decisions to sweeping and broad ones. Mm. When she was the Thurgood Marshall of the women's movement, she persuaded the Supreme Court to recognize women's equality, but by starting by defending the equal rights of men who were being discriminated against by laws that favored women. And Ginsburg thought that that would appeal to the chauvinistic sensibilities of the male judges of her time and then persuade them to see things from the woman's perspective. So in all that sense, she's a lawyer's lawyer and very, very savvy in pursuing her goals. At the same time, she's rated by many measures as among the most liberal justices, and she's willing to write quite fiery dissents, as she has in a bunch of recent cases. She gave a speech to the American Constitution Society just last week, which I heard, and she talked about the recent cases where she had dissented and where Congress responded by overturning the Supreme Court in the Lilly Ledbetter employment discrimination case. So I think she nicely combines a preference for incrementalism with a willingness to write very strong liberal dissents when necessary.
Jeffrey Rosen is with us. He's a law professor at George Washington University and the legal affairs editor for the New Republic magazine. We invite you to join the conversation, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court as we await a ruling on President Obama's Affordable Health Care Act. The journalist and legal scholar Jeffrey Rosen is our guest today. Rosen says that one of the defining tests for Chief Justice John Roberts is going to be his ability to avoid political polarization on the court. But it's not easy getting nine very opinionated people to put aside their individual agendas and act like one body. You can join us 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Jeffrey Rosen, you were talking earlier about that New York Times CBS poll that found 44% of Americans say they approved the Supreme Court's job performance, and some 75% who said that the justices are influenced by their political views. You've written about that opinion survey, that it may be more complicated than we think. I wanted you to talk about that, if you would. First of all, do we mind as a whole, do we think as Americans that our that body should be in some ways political? And how are we thinking about the Supreme Court these days?
Yes, it is complicated, as you say. According to one recent study by Nathan Persily of Columbia Law School, Americans already judge the court according to political criteria. Basically, they support the court when they think they would have ruled the same way the justices would have, or when they think the court overall is in tune with their general partisan views.
Yeah.
So if that's true, then the way for the court to maintain its high approval ratings isn't to have narrow unanimous decisions, but just to hand down decisions that majorities of the public agree with. And by that criteria, the Roberts Court actually has been more in tune with national minorities, rather national majorities than not. The public has supported the high-profile decisions, including both conservative rulings involving gun rights and partial birth abortion, and also liberal rulings upholding the regulation of global warming and striking down a Texas law banning sex between men.
Mm.
So as long as the court has been navigating that difficult water, its legitimacy was pretty high. What's harder to measure is the impact of highly polarizing decisions.
Yeah.
Bush v. Gore is an obvious example, because there the country's basically split 50-50. Democrats hate the court afterward, but Republicans like it a whole lot more.
Mm-hmm.
Within a year, people have short memories, and the ratings go back to where they were before. Essentially, to the degree that partisan rulings remind people that a majority of the justices are appointed by Republicans, which many people in polls don't know until it's sort of drummed into their consciousness by the headlines,
right,
that will make Republicans happy and Democrats not so happy. So figuring it all out, these conflicting impulses, is tough, but it is true that it may be too naive to imagine that Americans want the court to be unanimous, as John Roberts said they did.
Mm. Have we ever, in history, do we have a sense of how American citizens thought about the Supreme Court, 100, 200 years ago?
Well, of course, there weren't polls, or
of
at
course.
Least very good ones with quill pens and all that sort of stuff. But there were certainly vicious attacks on the justices. The pamphlets of the early 19th century were the blogs of their day, and Thomas Jefferson attacked John Marshall's court as a group of sappers and miners. And he accused John Marshall of twistifications, and then Roberts and Marshall reciprocated by calling Jefferson the great llama of the mountain, which is bewildering, but must have something to do with Monticello and mountains. Not quite sure what he meant. But, I think the most dramatic examples we have of the fact that the court is generally in tune with public opinion but can provoke dramatic backlashes when it isn't occur in the famous polarizing cases. So Dred Scott actually was not popular with the majority of the country when it handed down. It was trying to impose the view of a radical Southern minority on the country. And it provoked a civil war and lots of constitutional amendments. The decisions striking down the New Deal were greatly unpopular with President Roosevelt and a Democratic Congress, and it wasn't until Roosevelt overreached with his plan to pack the court to replace the older justices that the public turned against Roosevelt, but essentially Roosevelt won the war by the fact that the justices switched directions and started upholding the New Deal. So it's almost counterintuitive to think that the court has been a majoritarian institution more often than not. We tend to think of it as a heroic defender of unpopular minorities. But the truth is that it's been in tune with public opinion generally and tends to get into a lot of trouble when it's not.
What are you expecting in terms of reaction to the health care ruling? I mean, there's some sense that it'll be another 5-4 decision. It'll be close. It'll strike down some elements of the Health Care Act. And I guess the reaction will be what you're expecting, do you think? I mean, depending on your political partisan point of view, you'll get some reaction, and then will it settle in again? Or are you seeing something more significant at stake here?
Well, I definitely have given up predicting what's going to happen in the healthcare case, but let's assume that it's a 5-4 Republican-Democratic split, striking down the mandate and at least or other parts of the law. What would the reaction be? On the one hand, the mandate is deeply unpopular. In the New York Times poll, something like 70% of the country wanted the court to strike it down.
Right.
So you might think that would give the court a lot of leeway to do so without provoking a backlash. On the other hand, partisan lines would be drawn, and especially if President Obama attacks the court, as he did after the Citizens United decision, and makes it a campaign issue, then Democrats would likely rally behind him, especially after they're reminded of the partisan composition of the court, Republicans would obviously go against him, and the country would be divided, and the partisan effects would be pushing against each other. Where it all settles, hard to say, but certainly something seems to be changing just in the tenor of attacks on the court by lower court judges, as I mentioned, and even the relationship between lower court judges and President Obama. I thought that famous exchange between Obama and Judge Jerry Smith in Texas was remarkable, where Obama, acting almost more like a law professor than simply the president, said he expected the court to uphold health care, and Judge Smith demanded that he reaffirm his belief in the ability of judges to strike down unconstitutional laws in a pending challenge to the health care case. It was almost impudent, insolent for a lower court judge to demand the president reaffirm this basic principle, but it's like the president and Judge Smith were acting more like legal pundits than kind of high officers of state. And this punditization of the judiciary, I think, reflects an age when we're so losing confidence in the apolitical authority of the court that both sides feel emboldened to predict how decisions will be overturned, to cast themselves as shadow justices. Maybe this is part of a broader decline in the authority of institutions in general and of the general polarization of our political culture, but the tenor of the attacks on the court seems to be changing in very interesting ways.
801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Let's go to the phones. Chris is with us in Provo. Chris, welcome.
Thank you. I'd like to ask your guest, in reading about, for example, the Warren Court in the 50s and 60s, Chief Justice Warren really went out of his way in a lot of these important cases to convince the minority opinions that we needed to have more unanimity on the court because these were important decisions. And I think the court was held in high esteem. We're seeing, as you mentioned, all these 5-4 decisions, and they seem to be sides are pretty intransigent in saying we're going to be either one side or the other, 5-4. And I think that's led to some of the decline in the view of the court, that it's more political. And I think both the left and the right have to be held accountable, those liberal justices refusing to go along with important issues, or the conservative ones with the liberal when they're in the majority. And don't the justices themselves hold some of the blame for the court, all these 5-4, and not looking at the good of the court and how they're viewed, and maybe saying, okay, I may need to go along with the majority?
Yes, I think so. I think you put it very well indeed. You're absolutely right about the Warren Court. Many of its most famous decisions were not 5-4. Brown was unanimous. The Miranda decision, recognizing the Miranda rights of suspects, I think was 6-3 or higher. I may have some of these numbers not exactly to hand, but they were lopsided majorities. And moreover, those majorities were composed of justices appointed by presidents of both parties. Earl Warren was a Republican, Hugo Black was a Democrat. They were side by side in many of these cases. It's different now. Both, we have the first time that all of the conservative justices are appointed by Republicans and all the liberals by Democrats. And I think you're right that both sides have to take responsibility for this. Neither is willing to give an inch or to compromise. And perhaps it's because they don't trust the other side to give them back something in return when the votes are different, or perhaps it's part of a general polarization of the judiciary. But the result is that the court is held in less bipartisan esteem. Mm-hmm. So I really agree with your diagnosis of the problem.
Chris, thanks very much. 801-585-WEST, again, the number to join us. Are the justices on the court today, are they any more partisan? Do we have any sense of that than justices in times past?
An interesting question, and of course it depends how you measure partisanship. On the one hand, they're less partisan in the sense of being less directly affiliated with party politics. There's not a single former politician on this court. They're all either former appellate judges and one former dean of Harvard Law School, whereas more than half of the judges who decided the Brown versus Board of Education case had a political background. Earl Warren, the governor, Douglas, the former head of the Security and Exchange Commission, there were former senators. These were people who had deep connections to partisan politics. But that also allowed them to give and take more and be more amenable to compromise. And there have been studies suggesting this court is more partisan. If by partisan you just mean more ideological on one side or another, it's a more conservative court than any court in recent history, according to some scholarly measures. And Justice Stevens, in his interview, told me that every justice appointed after he was, with the exception of perhaps Ruth Bader Ginsburg, was more conservative than his or her predecessors. So it's more conservative, and the liberal justices may be responding by being more liberal, or at least by, as Chris suggested in the previous call, being less willing to compromise their liberal views. So that's, I guess, a long way of saying it's by some measures it is more partisan, but by others it isn't. But it certainly seems to be more polarized.
What kind of transformation? I'm not sure there is an ideological transformation, but how does being Chief Justice change your ideological perspective or the way you think of the decisions you're making? I mean, you mentioned Rehnquist, for example, and it seems to me when he became Chief Justice, didn't he come around on the issue of Miranda, for example?
He did. It was remarkable. He'd spent 20 years criticizing Miranda, and it came time to overturn it in 2003, and he wrote a 6-3 decision upholding it. Justice Scalia objected that he'd converted Miranda into the very Cheops pyramid of judicial arrogance.
Right.
I didn't know what a Cheops pyramid was until I was reading my kids the wonderful book A Little History of the World the other day, and I learned it's a monument to arrogance by an Egyptian pharaoh. But why did Rehnquist do this? Because he was willing to provide the sixth vote, maybe not the fifth, but the sixth, on a decision where he may have disagreed with it, but he thought the legitimacy of the court as a whole demanded a lopsided decision. And as Rehnquist said, Miranda had come to be accepted by the culture. That was a phrase that almost led Justice Scalia's head to explode. But, you know, Rehnquist cared about the fact that people had come to count on Miranda. When he was younger, Rehnquist was known as the Lone Ranger. When he was an associate justice, he was the most conservative one and would write these fire-breathing dissents. But when he became chief, he thought his role was to preside neutrally and impartially over the court. And he did so with efficiency. Justice Ginsburg said that he was the best chief she'd ever, well, I guess he was the only chief she'd ever served with, but I think that Thurgood Marshall said that he was the best chief that he'd ever served with, because his colleagues basically thought he was a straight shooter. And Roberts seemed to suggest at the beginning that he also cared about that institutional angle and would try to pursue it.
You write about that relationship between Rehnquist and Scalia in your book, and you talk about how Scalia has proved to be, you know, not that interested in building coalitions, more interested in kind of ideological purity, whereas Rehnquist, as he became Chief Justice, as you say, became more interested in that idea of consensus, sacrificing perhaps some of his ideological agenda for the sake of that. What about Roberts? Do you have any sense about the particular issues that he may be willing to sacrifice on, you know, in the interest of consensus?
Well, that is the $60,000 question in the healthcare case. I mean, there have not been a whole lot of cases where he has been willing to compromise things that he feels very strongly about. The voting rights case was the clearest example, that one we talked about, but that may have just been a temporary compromise on the way to striking it down next year. In Citizens United, Roberts famously responded to Justice Stevens, who objected that this wasn't a narrow decision, it was very broad, and he quoted Roberts saying generally cases should be narrow. And Roberts responded, it's not enough that a case be narrow, it also has to be right. That's a very different philosophy or approach than the one that he was articulating at the beginning of his tenure. So that's what makes the healthcare case just such a tremendous test of what kind of chief he wants to be. Does he care more about consensus or ideological purity? Is he willing to strike down the law because he thinks it's the right thing to do, or does he care about the effect on the court's legitimacy and on his own hopes for bipartisanship? I frankly don't know what choice he'll make. It seems like these are two competing impulses that he has, and we'll find out very soon which vision he's chosen to embrace.
Jeffrey Rosen is with us, law professor at George Washington University, the legal affairs editor for The New Republic. We need to take another break. Chris, thanks very much for the call. 801-585-WEST if you want to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. I would like to also hear from you, those of you on Facebook and Twitter as well. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the legal scholar Jeffrey Rosen. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Back to the phones. John is with us in Moab, Utah. John, welcome.
Well, I thank you for the discussion. I guess so Jefferson was the Dalai Lama of Mount Vernon. That's
great. Monticello.
Thought. I never thought of him that way, but they, in a sense, that's probably what he was. But I wanted to, I have kind of a comment and a question. It has to do with the Roberts Court. First of all, I'm Catholic, and I'm disgusted with their decisions and with their partisanship. And I think somehow under the leadership of Roberts that they've gone and applied almost a religious test to everything that comes before it. And so my question is, and in terms of being a chief justice, how does that differentiate him from the other justices, the fact that he's the chief justice? And that's my question.
It's an important question. I love the Dalai Lama line, and I think it's even better than Jefferson, so I'll definitely remember that one. as Chief Justice Roberts told me, he has really only one power. He has one vote, like all of his colleagues. He's first among equals, only in the sense that he speaks first at the conference where the justices discuss cases, because he's considered the most senior. They discuss cases in order of seniority, so he'll go first, and then Justice Scalia, who's been serving the longest, and then down to Justice Kagan, who's the most junior justice. And after they discuss cases, they vote. So if the Chief Justice is in the majority, in other words, if he has four other justices who agree with his position, he can either write the decision himself or assign it to the judge who best reflects his views. If he's in the minority, then the senior justice in the majority, generally Ruth Bader Ginsburg for the liberals, is a shadow chief justice, and she can write it herself or assign it to the judge who best reflects her views. If one of the judges is on the fence, then the chief justice may assign the opinion to him or her in order to keep that person in the majority. And that's why Kennedy gets all the great decisions, because he's the one who's always swinging back and forth in the middle. But aside from that important procedural power to frame arguments and to assign opinions when he's in the majority, the chief is just like his colleagues. You also asked, I think, you know, how has he behaved differently than his colleagues? And there certainly were some opinions where some of his conservative colleagues wanted to take a more ideologically pure or extreme position. Justice Thomas and Justice Scalia, for example, wanted to strike down the McCain-Feingold case in the first challenge to it, called Wisconsin Right to Life in 2007, I think it was.
Yeah.
Roberts, joined by Alito, had a narrower ruling saying we don't have to overturn precedents and we shouldn't if we don't have to, so he preferred to chip away at it rather than to overturn it. As it happened, just a few years later, he would vote to overturn it. And this preference for incrementalism has been attacked by both liberal and conservative colleagues. Scalia has attacked it as faux judicial restraint, which is fighting words on the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And Justice Breyer has suggested it's better to overturn decisions cleanly rather than to mischaracterize or chip away at them. So those are some of the things that he's done as Chief Justice.
So when Chief Justice Roberts, when you spoke with him after that frustrating first year, do you have any sense of, I'm not sure if you've talked to him lately, but do you have any sense of where he is on his effort or his desire, at least early on, to find a kind of sense of consensus? Do you have any sense that he's kind of ditched the idea altogether?
I don't. I've run into him, but haven't talked to him about this since the interview. He did say in the interview that his success would reflect the willingness of his colleagues to go along, and he'd try it for a while, and if it didn't work out, then they could just go back to having 5-4 decisions. So I don't know. Perhaps he's already given up, because he's had 5 or 6 years of pretty polarizing decisions. Maybe he still thinks that's important. Again, I think that we'll find out next week, and that's why healthcare is a test of whether he even believes in this vision at all. But I do think that if the court strikes down healthcare by a 5-4 vote, we would have to conclude that Roberts no longer believes in this vision, and however much he may or may not have tried to pursue it, he failed. I think things were more polarized than he expected, and therefore he's not making that a priority.
So this is a defining test in some ways for Roberts.
It is a defining test. I don't see how you could say that it wasn't. And it's not a when I suggested this, some conservative commenter suggested I was trying to intimidate the Chief Justice, which is laughable that a Chief Justice would care what any journalist had to say, let alone be intimidated. But I thought I was just stating the obvious, that even Roberts, I'd imagine, would himself have to agree that if the court strikes down health care by 5-4 after having done the same for affirmative action and campaign finance and all these other cases, then his goal of achieving unanimity had failed. I mean, what the explanation is another matter, and I'll be interested if the court does strike down health care to try to reconstruct what happened. I'd love to talk to Roberts again, obviously, if I had the chance, or talk to his colleagues or to clerks and find out why he chose to abandon this vision. But it's an absolutely, no question about it, a defining moment.
What happens if we lose trust in the Supreme Court as a public?
Well, of course, as we've been discussing, it depends who the we is, Tonto, as the Lone Ranger said. You know, it might be that Republicans like it and Democrats don't, as long as it's conservative. But the court's legitimacy is a precious thing. I think Roberts felt that very acutely, and he said he was struck by how many times around the table people would say, "This is how will this affect the court's legitimacy?" They're aware of the fragility of the public's trust and the fact. The famous examples that are cited of President Jackson saying after one of Chief Justice Marshall's decisions that he didn't like, John Marshall has made his decision, now let him enforce it. The court, after all, has no troops. There was the remarkable decision in the Little Rock Schools case, Cooper versus Aaron, where the justices were so afraid that the president, President Eisenhower, would not support them and that the state authorities would defy them, that they signed their decision in ink to show that they were unanimous and serious. So I think that the court is afraid at certain times in its history that when people lose trust in it, at worst they won't obey it, and at best they'll just be so unwilling to accept the decisions as neutral and try so hard to overturn them that we'll just have constant culture wars over the judiciary, as we seem to be having over the past couple of years. It's not a good thing for those on either side of the political spectrum who care about the rule of law.
Jeffrey Rosen, he is a law professor at George Washington University, again, the legal affairs editor for the New Republic magazine. He's the author of the book, The Supreme Court, The Personalities and Rivalries That Defined America. He joined us by phone from Ohio. Jeffrey Rosen, thanks very much for taking the time.
Thanks. It was a really wonderful conversation, and thank you for reading the book so carefully.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Matthew Martin and Susan Anderson. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.